KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. The daily tariff increases between the U.S. and China are over for now. We hear from a Trump supporter in Kentucky who says the trade war is threatening his soybean farm. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Meta faces federal regulators in court trying to stop them from breaking off Instagram and WhatsApp. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Michelle Martin. The government says Meta tried to buy or bury the competition, making it harder for smaller companies to compete. Also, a celebration of Black-owned bookstores from coast to coast. It is Monday, April 14th. On this day in 1828, Noah Webster got rid of the U in words like color and honor, publishing his American Dictionary of the English Language. He also wanted soup spelled S-O-O-P. They weren't all winners. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Louise Schiavone. El Salvador's President Nayib Bukele meets with President Trump at the White House today. His country, now a key player in the Trump administration's tough line on people in the U.S. without legal status. In one high-profile case, the Trump administration has not yet provided a federal judge with additional information on a man wrongly deported to El Salvador. NPR's Chandelise Duster reports that despite a Supreme Court order that the administration helped return Kilmar Abrego Garcia to the U.S. NPR's Chandelise Duster has more.
A Department of Homeland Security official wrote in a court filing on Sunday that there are, quote, no updates for the court on Kilmar Armando Abrego Garcia. A State Department official has said Abrego Garcia is, quote, alive and secure in El Salvador's terrorism confinement center. Justice Department lawyers also argued in a separate filing Sunday that a federal court cannot compel the executive branch to engage with the Salvadoran government to facilitate his return. NPR has reached out to Abrego Garcia's attorneys for comment. They previously said the government, quote, must act without further delay to ensure his safe return. Chandelise Duster, NPR News.
As President Trump's tariffs policies evolve, the world is watching for next steps. The president says he expects eventual tariffs on semiconductors, although the administration announced at the end of last week it would temporarily exclude electronic goods like smartphones, computers, and semiconductor chips, items made or assembled in China. Richard Haass, President Emeritus of the Council on Foreign Relations, says America's trading partners are standing by for possible trade-offs.
He's famous for, quote-unquote, the art of the deal, but you can always get a deal if you're prepared to compromise. And the fact that these tariffs have been put on and already there's lots of walking back creates the impression that if the United States is forced to pay a price for its policy, it will back off.
China has levied retaliatory tariffs of 125% on American goods. NPR's Scott Horsley looks at Wall Street, where stocks opened sharply higher.
Stock in Apple jumped sharply on news of the tariff exclusion, which came out late Friday. China's Commerce Ministry calls it a small step in the right direction. Even that small step may not last, however. President Trump and his Commerce Secretary say electronic products could be hit with new tariffs as part of a future crackdown on imported semiconductors. The ongoing trade war has prompted OPEC to lower its forecast for oil demand both this year and next. Retail gasoline prices have been falling in recent days. AAA reports the average price of regular gas is now $3.18 a gallon. That's down about 7 cents from a week ago, but 10 cents higher than this time last month. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
The Dow is up 387 points, the NASDAQ up 263. This is NPR News. The sightseeing helicopter tour company whose chopper fatally crashed into New York's Hudson River last Thursday is shutting down operations immediately. The Federal Aviation Administration made the announcement this weekend. A family of five visiting from Spain and the pilot all died. At the Masters Golf Tournament in Augusta, Georgia, Sunday, history was made as Northern Ireland's Rory McIlroy became only the sixth person to capture golf's Grand Slam. Steve Putterman reports.
For more than a decade, Rory McIlroy had been trying and falling short of winning the Masters, the only one of the four major tournaments he hadn't won. On Sunday, he did it in a roller coaster final round. Twice, McIlroy had the lead, then lost it. And on the final hole, he missed an easy putt that would have clinched the win. That forced a sudden-death playoff, which McIlroy did win. He admitted there were lots of bumps.
I didn't make it easy today. I was nervous. It was one of the toughest days I've ever had on the golf course.
When McIlroy made the winning putt, he sank to his knees and began to cry. For NPR News, I'm Steve Futterman in Augusta, Georgia.
A pet tortoise and his family have been reunited weeks after a ferocious tornado tore through parts of Mississippi. Myrtle the tortoise had disappeared after trees fell on his home in the rural Kokomo area in the middle of March. Weeks later, a neighbor found the tortoise injured and took him to the Central Mississippi Turtle Rescue. Tiffany Emanuel and her family are now nursing Myrtle the tortoise back to health. I'm Louise Schiavone, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Capital One with the Capital One Saver Card. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at MacFound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fadel. In a few minutes, we'll hear how the trade war is threatening American soybean farmers.
But first, the Trump administration said late Friday that mobile phones, computers, and other electronics will not be part of the triple-digit tariffs against China. That carve-out might not last, though, and neither side appears ready to back down. NPR's John Ruich has been following all these twists and turns from Beijing, and he's with us now to tell us more. Good morning, John.
Good morning.
So no new tariffs. And what about that carve out for electronics? Can you tell us more?
Yeah, late on Friday, Customs and Border Protection posted a notice online. It was full of legalese and arcane tariff codes. And what it translated into was no tariffs on mobile phones, computers, memory chips, flat screens, LEDs, stuff like that. This is substantial because electronics account for roughly a quarter of Chinese exports to the U.S. China's Commerce Ministry responded fairly quickly over the weekend, calling it a small step toward correcting the error of imposing those so-called reciprocal tariffs on China and on other countries.
How is this being interpreted? Is it seen as a sign of goodwill or maybe a face-saving way to de-escalate this trade war that Trump started?
It was initially, but it doesn't look like it is. You know, Trump's come out on social media to say that nobody's getting off the hook. These products are just moving to a different tariff bucket. Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick explained it on Sunday on ABC's This Week.
So all those products are going to come under semiconductors, and they're going to have a special focused type of tariff to make sure that those products get reshored.
So he's saying they're exempted from the so-called reciprocal tariffs that Trump announced so that they're sort of off the menu for negotiation. Why? Because they're going to be lumped in with semiconductors under a separate tariff that he says will be announced in the next month or two, and not just on China. And the idea is to force supply chains of those products back to the U.S.
So where do things stand from China's perspective?
Well, China's been pretty consistent. They've projected defiance throughout this. You know, Trump seems to be waiting for Chinese leader Xi Jinping to pick up the phone and call him. That's not how China operates. It doesn't mean that they're not open to discussion, though. I asked Andy Rothman about this last night here in Beijing. He advises investors and corporate boards on China, and he's been on a trip here meeting companies and contacts.
I think the Chinese have made clear they want to negotiate. They want to resolve this problem, but they're not sure what the U.S. is looking for. They're also very unsure about what the U.S. is willing to offer in return.
Meanwhile, China has taken steps to, you know, gird for these tariffs. One part of that is deepening relations with other countries, in particular neighbors. And it just so happens that Xi Jinping left today on his first overseas trip of the year.
Okay, now that's interesting. So where is he headed?
First stop is Vietnam. He's in Hanoi now. He heads to Malaysia next for 3 days and then to Cambodia. The Chinese government's projecting China as sort of an anchor in rough seas, a reliable trading partner. In fact, Xi had a piece in the Vietnamese Communist Party's mouthpiece newspaper today calling for joint efforts to protect the multilateral trading system and maintain stable supply chains. But these Southeast Asian countries are in a tough spot. They've all benefited to some extent from the trade friction between the U.S. and China in recent years because manufacturing has moved their way. And also, they are all negotiating or seeking to negotiate with the Trump administration to keep the tariffs off.
That is NPR's John Wuerch in Beijing. John, thank you.
You're welcome.
Now, China consumes more than half of all soybeans exported from the U.S., so this trade war is hitting America's soybean industry hard. Caleb Ragland is watching the tariffs and retaliatory tariffs between the U.S. and China from his farm in Magnolia, Kentucky, where he grows soybeans and serves as president of the American Soybean Association. Good morning, Caleb. Thanks for waking up early with us.
Good morning. Happy to be here.
So the U.S. has 145% tariffs on Chinese goods, China 135% on American goods. How do these impact soybean farmers like you and the industry at large? 125%. Sorry, I correct myself there.
Well, it's hard to keep up at the current rate.
Yeah.
But, but we're very concerned. As you mentioned, China is the largest buyer of U.S. soybeans internationally. We export right at 50% of all soybeans produced in the U.S., and China purchased 52% of U.S. exports last year. So if you see a soybean field, every fourth row of soybeans went to China last year.
So what does this mean for farmers then?
Well, we have a precedent from the first trade war. At that time, one out of three rows went to China. And when the dust has settled, we have lost about 9% of all U.S. production and exports to China that's been replaced by our competitors in South America, mainly Brazil. China has even invested majorly in infrastructure there, in ports, in bridges, in rail, in roads, and we're likely not to get that back. Our grave concern is we could permanently lose another big chunk of our export market that we are dependent on for our production. And if we don't have that demand internationally, we're going to have to find more uses here domestically. And the result will be, at least in the short term, that we'll lose price due to low demand and high supply. And the U.S. farm economy is in a tough spot, and we just don't have any room for error right now.
I mean, can you weather this trade war? I mean, can your farm survive it? Can other people's farms survive it?
Well, we're very concerned, quite frankly. Last year, we're told that there were four times more defaults on farm loans due to the weak farm economy, and working capital is low, interest rates are higher, cost of production are at record highs, inflation has wreaked havoc on everything that we use, whether it be equipment or whether it be chemicals, whether it be seed, because everybody down the supply chain that takes care of us, their costs are higher too. So it's a tough spot. We desperately need strong demand for our soybeans so we can receive a good price. And so we're needing opportunities both domestically and abroad now, and not just in the future.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you have been very public about your support for the president. You voted for him three times, but you've also, I'm listening to you talk about the pain that you felt during the first administration with the tariffs that were put then kept during the Biden administration. Now these steeper tariffs, which he promised on the campaign trail. So did you not vote for these tariffs in some ways?
Well, we knew that that was a possibility. What we also know is that President Trump put a phase one trade deal in place with China during the first administration. Mm-hmm. And we also had precedent that we didn't have much trade activity in the past 4 years as well. So we had to make a decision based on a lot of different factors. But I believe President Trump and his administration have the opportunity here to get some major trade deals done. And we hope that's what they're doing, because we must have trade, as I've said. And that is what our farmers are dependent on. We are great at producing soybeans and other ag products as well, but soybeans are the number one ag export. So we're kind of at the tip of the spear here.
What do you want the president to do if you could ask him or tell him what to do in this moment and what farmers need?
We are actively in discussions with the administration, and we need trade, and we need trade deals, and that's the bottom line. And I believe the president wants to do that. I think he cares about our country, but we must have trade, and we need opportunities now. And
do you want him to reverse these tariffs?
We want him to get the best deal possible. If that means tariffs for a short term, fine, but we can't be in a tariff war for years on end, because we'll die before then.
Caleb Ragland is a soybean farmer in Magnolia, Kentucky, and president of the American Soybean Association. Thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome.
Rory McIlroy has made it to golf's top tier. His win at the Masters tournament yesterday makes him just the sixth golfer to earn a career Grand Slam, winning all four of golf's major championships. Steve Futterman reports on the tournament's final round from Augusta.
Rory McIlroy repeatedly squandered what seemed to be an insurmountable lead. It started at the very first hole. McIlroy, admittedly nervous, ended up with a double bogey. His two-stroke lead was gone. By the 13th hole, he had built up a three-stroke lead. Then he hit the ball into a creek, and soon that lead was also gone. On the 18th, up by one, McIlroy needed to make just a simple four-foot putt to win, and amazingly, he missed it. The startled crowd couldn't believe it. That forced a sudden-death playoff. On the first hole, McIlroy faced with a three-foot putt, and a history of disappointment at Augusta sank it.
The long journey is over. McIlroy has his masterpiece.
The call on CBS, McIlroy collapsed to the ground, sobbing into his hands. At last, he had captured the one major tournament missing from his resume, the Masters. Now the crowd celebrated. Marco Moretto from Montreal, Canada, couldn't believe what he had seen.
This was incredible sporting drama. He is an amazing champion. He showed grit. He showed determination. He showed how mentally tough he is.
Soon afterwards, McIlroy was presented with the famed Masters green jacket by last year's winner, Scottie Scheffler.
And Scottie, I would be grateful if you would please do the honor of placing the green jacket on Rory.
McIlroy had been so close, so many times, with so much heartbreak for more than a decade, but could never quite win here.
Yeah, it's been difficult. It's been 14 long years, but thankfully I got the job done.
Greg Allen with RTE Irish Radio has been covering Rory McIlroy since he was 15.
He goes from being great to being someone who's undisputably a legend, because that's what goes with being a winner of the career Grand Slam.
McIlroy joins golf's royalty, Tiger Woods, Jack Nicklaus, Gary Player, Ben Hogan, and Gene Sarazen, as the only winners of all four majors, the U.S. Open, the British Open, the PGA, and now the Masters. For NPR News, I'm Steve Futterman in Augusta, Georgia.
This is NPR News.
Thank you. On the next Fresh Air, actor Richard Kind. You've seen him on countless TV shows and films in his 40-year career. Only Murders in the Building, Curb Your Enthusiasm, Spin City, Mad About You, A Serious Man, and his Bing Bong in Inside Out, just to name a few. He's now the announcer and sidekick on Everybody's Live with John Mulaney. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Proven Winners with Proven Winners Color Choice Shrubs, offering flowering shrubs and evergreens selected for home landscapes. More at provenwinnerscolorchoice.com/NPR. From Imaginable Futures, celebrating the hard work, commitment, and achievements of the 1 in 5 college students who are parents. More at imaginablefutures.com. From Uma, a cloud-based phone service for any size business, with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere at uma.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Michelle Martin. A new book celebrating black bookstores just hit the shelves. It's called Prose to the People, and it includes profiles of more than 50 bookshops, old and new, that have shaped the country's literary landscape. The bright scrapbook-style book includes the stories behind individual stores, with a foreword by the late Nikki Giovanni, written before her death last December. The collection has been described as a road trip companion for black history buffs as well as bookstore fanatics. So buckle up as we meet booksellers from New York City to Portland, Oregon. But we're going to begin in Atlanta, Georgia, with Katie Mitchell, the editor behind Prose to the People.
Prose started from a deep curiosity. I'm a bookseller and I'm also a customer of bookstores. And I saw how transformative they had been in my life. And I see them as transformative as the black church or black colleges, but I saw that they were understudied as an institution. So the book starts in 1830s with D. Ruggles books and goes all the way till today. And, you know, I think it'll be really cool if people read Prose to the People and then are inspired to go to these bookstores when they find themselves in those cities.
Hey, my name is Courtney Woods, and I co-own The Book Joint with my mom, Verlaine Singletary. We own a bookstore on the south side of Chicago. I came back home from college, so I started researching literacy rates on the south side, and that's really what aligned me with the mission. There are bookstores in Chicago, but most of them focus on downtown and the north side. Adult literacy rates on the South Side are very, very low. So we saw that. We saw that there does not seem to be a plan of bringing more bookstores over here. So we decided that's where we need to be. And from there, we opened a shipping container, and we were there in that shipping container for 3 years. So throughout the brutal winters, the super hot summers, but with the support of our community. We worked really, really hard in that box. So last year, we finally made it to the point where we could go ahead and open a physical storefront.
I am Victoria Scott Miller, co-owner of North Carolina's first Black-owned children's bookstore, Liberation Station, and we are based in Raleigh, North Carolina. Liberation Station Bookstore started with curiosity of our eldest son, Langston, who was interested in writing books. What is it like to sell books as a family? I think it is a communal opportunity. You have my husband, who represents fatherhood. You have Emerson, who is an artist, but he also represents a community of neurodivergency, right? And so we get to see creativity and how reading and writing impact him. And then also you have our now 14-year-old Langston. And then you have me as mother, creator, also a children's book author. And so selling a book is, you know, is one component, but I think curating our inventory collectively has been a really profound experience for all of us.
My name is Gabrielle Davenport. I'm a co-founder at BEM Books and More, and we are based in Brooklyn, New York. We specialize in Black food literature. Food really gets at all the conversations that are most pertinent. Culturally, we can talk about climate, we can talk about race and place, we can talk about education. There's so many things that food is a pathway into. We also have a huge collection of kids' books that are, you know, grandparents cooking with grandbabies, and it's wonderful. We have, you know, there's a Dominican one and a Haitian one and plenty of Black American examples and everything in between. I don't think you need to enjoy cooking to get into food writing. Even if you are not a person who enjoys cooking or likes being in the kitchen, it can still transport you to a time and a place and a specific set of feelings.
It's always amazing when people tell me they put this bookstore on their itinerary because they feel this is a place to be. Hello, my name is Charles Hanna. I am the co-owner with my wife, Michelle Lewis, of Third Eye Books, Accessories and Gifts, located in beautiful Portland, Oregon. Well, to live in Portland is a process of re-examining oneself as a Black person, because you have to have the information how this state was organized, how this state was chartered and set up as a white-only state at the very beginning. There's certain laws that people just kind of wrap their head around. It's like, wow, because Portland was kind of behind the times. Now Portland is kind of picked up progressively, but there's still a lot of history here that still needs to be unpacked. We're positioning this bookstore to be an oasis in a desert. There's a desert of knowledge out there. People are looking for more voices, more opportunities to learn new things.
Good day starts out with some kiddos coming in.
My name is Hannah Oliver Depp. I am the co-owner of Loyalty Bookstores. We are based in the Washington, D.C. neighborhood of Petworth, and we are dedicated to uplifting marginalized and diverse voices from BIPOC, queer, disabled, and immigrant communities.
People want to sell our tragedies, but we're here to celebrate the full breadth of what it means to be Black in America, to be part of the diaspora. There's so much to our stories. To be represented in a book like Prose to the People is really seeing the depth of this beauty that Loyalty is just one link in the chain of. It really just shows how varied all of the different Black bookstores are, but also represents how we are interwoven together. It's just, honestly, it makes me quite teary.
That was Katie Mitchell, Courtney Woods, Victoria Scott Miller, Gabrielle Davenport, Charles Hanna, and Hannah Oliver Depp. Prose to the People is out now. This is NPR News.
Alrighty, here it goes again. Pop band OK Go is back with a new record, their first in 10 years.
This actually feels like the most comfortable in our skin I think we've ever sounded.
I'm Elsa Chang. We'll hear from OK Go on their latest album and the adjacent possible on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. A trial opened today on whether Meta violated competition laws when it acquired Instagram and WhatsApp. NPR's Bobby Allen reports.
The FTC says Meta acquired Instagram in 2012 and WhatsApp 2 years later as part of a strategy to eliminate competition and maintain monopoly power over the whole social media market. The government says Meta is motivated by a buy or bury strategy, meaning Meta would try to purchase a rival or put them out of business entirely.
NPR's Bobby Allen. Chinese President Xi Jinping said today that no one wins in a trade war. He did not mention the U.S. specifically, but commented at a time of rising tensions between the U.S. and China over tariffs. Caleb Ragland is worried about what happens next. He's a soybean farmer in Magnolia, Kentucky.
China is the largest buyer of U.S. soybeans internationally. We export right at 50% of all soybeans produced in the U.S., and China purchased 52% of U.S. exports last year. So if you see a soybean field, every fourth row of soybeans went to China last year.
He says it's already hard for farmers to make a living. The private space company Blue Origin launched a rocket into space today with a 6-person crew, all women. It successfully landed back on Earth nearly 11 minutes later. This is NPR News in Washington. Election officials in Ecuador have declared incumbent President Daniel Noboa the winner in yesterday's runoff presidential election. The vote took place at a time of unprecedented violence in Ecuador related to the drug trade. Lawmakers in Hungary are preparing to vote on a controversial constitutional amendment that aims to restrict the freedom of assembly for members of the LGBTQ community. NPR's Rob Schmitz reports.
The amendment, which is predicted to be passed by 2/3 of Hungary's parliament, would permanently codify a ban on public events held by LGBTQ communities in Hungary, including the annual Budapest Pride Parade. It will also provide a constitutional basis for denying gender identities or sexual characteristics of minority groups. The amendment, the 15th to Hungary's constitution since 2011, gives legal support to a law that was fast-tracked in March. That law also gives police powers to use facial recognition tools to identify individuals that attend prohibited events. Legal experts say the law and the amendment violate Hungary's constitution and could be used to ban public assemblies by any group in the future. Rob Schmitz, NPR News, Warsaw.
Myrtle is back home in Mississippi weeks after the pet tortoise disappeared during a tornado. The AP reports that a neighbor found it, took it for treatment, and notified the owner, Tiffany Emanuel, who says of Myrtle, he's been through a lot. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Amazon Business, offering business buying services from office supplies to IT essentials and maintenance tools to help bring visions to life. Learn more at AmazonBusiness.com. From the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at CIDQ.org/NPR. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Michelle Martin. A case considered the most significant legal challenge in Meta's history starts today in Washington, D.C. The trial pits the Federal Trade Commission against the social media giant. It's expected to last 2 months, and executives, including CEO Mark Zuckerberg, are set to take the witness stand. The case centers on the question of whether Meta broke competition laws when it acquired Instagram and WhatsApp. NPR's Bobby Allen joins us to talk about what the trial could mean for the future of Meta and the entire social media landscape. Welcome, Bobby. Thanks for joining us.
Hey there, Michelle.
What exactly is the government's case against Meta, and what is it asking for?
The FTC says Meta acquired Instagram in 2012 and WhatsApp 2 years later as part of a strategy to eliminate competition and maintain monopoly power over the whole social media market. The government says Meta is motivated by a buy or bury strategy, meaning Meta would try to purchase a rival or put them out of business entirely. The FTC says this is illegal, and the only way to remedy it is for Meta to be broken up. So the FTC is pushing for Instagram and WhatsApp to be spun off into separate companies. The government says this will allow smaller social media companies to compete for consumers and ad dollars and loosen Meta's grip on the industry. And as you might imagine, Michelle, Meta is fighting back against this pretty hard.
Do we have a sense of how Meta is likely to respond in court?
Yeah, Meta is expected to say it's always competed fairly and that regulators are trying to punish the company for being so successful and so innovative. Lawyers for Meta have said in court filings that, you know, the acquisitions of Instagram and WhatsApp, and look, they were quite prescient and made the company really successful. Meta says they were approved by regulators at the time. So to go back years and try to unwind these deals, Meta says is unreasonable. Meta also says by breaking up an American tech company, who are you going to benefit? Rivals abroad, including Chinese competitors.
What would it mean for people who use Facebook, Instagram, and WhatsApp if Meta had to spin them off into separate companies?
Well, the FTC says it would mean more competition and therefore better quality social media services. The FTC says since Meta is a monopoly, all of its apps have become pretty lousy and full of intrusive advertising. The agency also says privacy protections for users has suffered. So, you know, if the FTC is to be believed here, a breakup would mean just better quality social media apps for all of us. But Meta says the opposite, that a breakup would make each of its individual apps less integrated and just worse overall.
So we have been talking about the legal case just now, but let's pivot back to the politics. Does Mark Zuckerberg's relationship with Trump play into this?
Yeah, this case first started in Trump's first term. That's when Trump was at war with Zuckerberg. And until very recently, Trump has not been a fan of him. Trump even threatened to throw Zuckerberg in prison before the 2024 presidential election, saying if Zuckerberg did anything to hurt Trump on the campaign trail, he would, quote, spend the rest of his life in prison. Now, in recent months, Zuckerberg has been ingratiating himself with the Trump administration, like so many others in Silicon Valley. Zuckerberg has publicly praised Trump. Meta donated $1 million to Trump's inaugural committee fund. He would have made these company-wide shifts to appease Trump, like ending Facebook and Instagram's fact-checking program and rolling back diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives. Zuckerberg has also made several visits to Trump's Mar-a-Lago, and there has been tons of speculation in Washington about whether the Trump administration would settle with Meta and not go forward with this trial. But so far, Michelle, all indications are that this case will be going on for weeks inside of a federal courtroom in Washington.
That is NPR's Bobby Allen. Bobby, I know you'll be watching it, so thank you.
Thanks, Michelle.
Government officials say university protesters supporting Palestinians should be deported from Germany. German authorities say the country's historical responsibility toward the Jewish people and the state of Israel are part of the rationale. NPR's Fatima El-Kassab reports.
Police dragging protesters from a pro-Palestinian encampment at Berlin's Free University last May. In Germany, authorities at the highest level have taken notice of these protests.
My name's Cooper. I'm 27. I moved to Berlin in September of 2023.
Cooper Longbottom came from Seattle to do a master's in social work. When we spoke on the phone, Longbottom described getting involved in pro-Palestinian protests in the city shortly after the war in Gaza began.
I joined demonstrations as well as started organizing on campus to demand specific things of the university, like an academic boycott of Israeli institutions.
Then, in January this year, Longbottom received a letter from the Berlin immigration authorities.
The letter that I received essentially said that they intended to deport me.
Longbottom is one of four demonstrators, two from Ireland, one from Poland, who have been told they are to be deported from Germany over accusations of anti-Semitism and support for terrorism, over alleged actions at protests against Israel's war in Gaza. In an email to NPR, Berlin's immigration office confirmed it had revoked the residence permit of four, what it called, pro-Palestinian activists. It said this was, quote, in connection with a pro-Palestinian protest where masked individuals entered a university building and caused property damage, including graffiti. It added that criminal proceedings are still ongoing, but did not say what the individuals were being charged with and said it would not comment further for privacy reasons. Defense lawyer Alexander Gorski says they haven't been told what they're being charged with.
They have no criminal convictions. As criminal defense lawyers, we haven't even seen the files yet, so we don't even know what exactly our individual clients are accused of.
Roberta Murray got the same letter back in January.
I was actually out doing shopping and I was in the middle of a supermarket when I opened my email.
Murray is a 31-year-old artist from Ireland who works at a cafe in Berlin and has lived there for years.
And then in March, we received a very long document outlining why we're being deported and telling us that we're such a threat to the German society that we have to leave the country by April 21st.
NPR has seen the letter which says if you do not voluntarily leave the country by April 21st, you are hereby threatened with deportation to Ireland. Longbottom, the American student, risks losing a visa. But for the Irish demonstrators who are European citizens, the right to reside anywhere in the European Union is enshrined in EU law as a founding principle. But while the letter cites EU law and alleges they are deportable because they pose a significant threat to security, Gorski says that hasn't been proven yet.
Normally that is only achieved if you have higher prison sentences. In this case, none of the four have ever been criminally convicted of a crime.
The letter sent to Murray, one of the Irish citizens, says, quote, the right of Israel to exist, its protection and the integrity of the State of Israel are matters of German state policy, and that at no time should there be any doubt that opposing movements within Germany will be tolerated in any way. Lawyer Gorski says he's never seen the idea used to justify deportation before. Ireland's Prime Minister has said he will raise the issue of the two Irish nationals with the German authorities. The American student, Cooper Longbottom, says no one from the Trump administration has been in contact yet. Fatima Al-Kassab, NPR News, London.
This is NPR News.
China has seen remarkable economic growth the last few decades. Now it's slowing. Still, Beijing is standing firm in its trade showdown with the U.S. Next time here and now.
Big news stories don't always break on your schedule. But with the NPR app, news, culture, and podcasts are ready when you want them. In your pocket. Download the NPR app today.
Good morning, I'm Michelle Martin. Last week we told you about all the wallets and a urinal left in Ubers over the past year, but what about airplane luggage? A company that buys and sells unclaimed bags says it's found a full sheet of $2 bills, a letter from Eleanor Roosevelt, a chia pet of Ice Spice, also a duffel bag full of rocks. Just rocks. The owner of that bag probably isn't as mad as whoever left behind a $40,000 diamond ring. Finders keepers, it's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From the Nature Conservancy, committed to protecting and preserving the planet during Earth Month and every month through the bold power of local and global action. Nature.org/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Uncertainties around President Trump's foreign policy are reinvigorating many Ukrainian Americans' support for their homeland. The U.S. is home to more than 1 million people of Ukrainian ancestry. Reporter Patrick Davis visited some of them in Central Texas.
For one afternoon in the Austin, Texas suburb of Leander, an 1860s farmhouse was transformed into an Ukrainian cultural center. There were traditional foods, vendors, and musical performances. The main attraction at the Many Faces, One Force exhibit is artist Yana Nikutina's collection of 77 portraits of Ukrainian and American women from Central Texas. Nikutina says the brightly colored pop art pieces highlight the ways women support Ukrainians.
A lot of women teaching children, some volunteering in different organizations, some help Ukrainian army, some help Ukrainian children.
Ukrainians in the U.S. help the war effort however they can. Some raise awareness with events like this one. Others contribute to the almost $4 billion Ukraine sees in yearly remittances. With uncertainties regarding President Trump's foreign policy and fears of Russian influence in the U.S., some Ukrainians feel their support is needed now more than ever. Composer and pianist Alex Siedin is performing at the exhibit. Like Nikutina, he uses his art to support his homeland.
So what we can do like artists, I decided to create like full solo piano album about what's going on in Ukraine.
That album is Out of Homeland, and it features compositions titled Far From Home, Prayer, and this song, Fight for the Future. Siedin came to the U.S. as a refugee in 2022. He feels safe on American soil and does what he can to support his musician friends back in Ukraine.
We're still in connections. We still do music. For example, if I need to record some cellos, violins, I send all of that to my friends to Ukraine. I know they need to have job too.
In addition to helping his friends, Siedin says his music also helps him stay hopeful.
I hope it should be peace soon. I hope it will never happen again. You know, it's pretty sad what's going on right now, and I lost friends too.
Organizer Kate Voynova says the event also connects local Ukrainian Americans with the broader Central Texas community. Voynova works with Liberty Ukraine, an Austin-based nonprofit that raises money for protective equipment for Ukrainian soldiers, as well as hospitals and mental health support. As the war drags on, Voynova is confident that Ukraine will survive with its borders intact. But after living in the U.S. since 2019, she worries Americans are becoming apathetic about the Ukrainian cause.
Our Ukrainian part already accepted that like war happening and like we need to somehow resist, right? As for now, my American part is really worried about what's going on to United States after this Russian influence is increasing in the United States.
Voynova has seen the negative impact Russian influence can have on a nation. She hopes her adopted homeland will hold its ground. For NPR News, I'm Patrick Davis in Leander, Texas.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Faldin.
Will personal electronics from China get to dodge U.S. tariffs for long?
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Progressive Insurance, helping protect small businesses with a variety of coverages like general liability, workers' compensation, and commercial auto. More at progressivecommercial.com.
I'm David Brancaccio in Los Angeles. Tech stocks are pointing upward on news over the weekend that the Trump administration will exempt imports of smartphones, laptops, and some other electronics from the highest tariff rates. Apple stock is up 3.9% at the moment, but the Trump team is issuing conflicting signals, as Marketplace's Henry Epp reports.
President Donald Trump said Sunday that electronics from China will still face a 20% import tax. That's much lower than the 145% tariff the administration has imposed on other imports from the country. Most iPhones sold in the U.S. are made in China, so the lower tariff rate gives Apple something of a reprieve. Stocks rallied on the news. Some analysts interpreted the move as a sign the administration could continue to carve out exemptions for different sectors of the economy. But Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick stressed over the weekend that additional tariffs are coming for electronics imports soon. The administration plans to announce new tariffs on devices that use semiconductors within the next month or two, Lutnick told ABC. He said those additional taxes are needed to, quote, reshore manufacturing of computer chips in the U.S. I'm Henry Epp for Marketplace.
Checking the screens, NASDAQ is up 1.9%. The S&P is up 1.7%. The Dow at the moment up 535 points, 1.3%. As a guide to what you pay to borrow, the 10-year interest rate is down at 4.42%. This is the time of year it falls on me to be that guy who nudges you that tomorrow's the tax filing deadline. Depending on the complexity of your taxes, one option might be the IRS Direct File program. Now, if you qualify, you can file your taxes electronically there for free. Third parties can also do it, but it's often not free. The Direct File program is in its second year, and it's now open to people in 25 states. Here's Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes.
Direct File is for taxpayers with relatively simple federal returns. You can't use the program if you, for example, get income from the gig economy, or you itemize your deductions. And IRS spokesman Anthony Burke says so far,
if they qualify for it, what we have heard is that taxpayers like Direct File.
About 141,000 people successfully filed with the pilot program last year. An estimated 19 million were eligible. We're still waiting on the count for this season, but
it's still unclear to me what the future of the program will be.
Joe Hughes is with the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy. He points out some Republican lawmakers have pushed to end Direct File, saying it's not a good use of resources. The IRS said in a 2024 report that the agency spent about $25 million through the end of the pilot.
They've also discussed whether or not the IRS actually has the authority to administer such a program.
In his confirmation hearing, Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent pledged to keep Direct File up and running this year, but didn't make any promises about the future. I'm Stephanie Hughes from Marketplace.
There are new data this morning showing crafty businesses got out ahead of possible new tariffs last month by importing from China like mad before new import taxes actually hit. In March, we didn't know who and how high, but we did know new tariffs were coming on April the 2nd. No secret there. The numbers today show China exports shot up 12.4% in March compared to a year earlier. That'll now change amid the tariff walls on both sides. We already know that China's exports of rare minerals fell 11% for the first quarter as Beijing tightened its control of these substances, critical for EVs and other tech.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Bitwarden Password Manager, designed to protect users who need access to secure logins for personal or work accounts from any device anywhere. Bitwarden.com. And by Schwab. Schwab offers investors choices like full-service wealth management, self-directed investing options, and trading on thinkorswim. More at schwab.com.
Some Democrats on Capitol Hill have called for an investigation into whether President Trump or other members of the administration engaged in insider trading in the hours before the president's big turnaround on some major tariffs last Wednesday. The morning of the big turn, the president, apparently referring to stocks, wrote on his Truth Social platform, "This is a great time to buy." Now, we reported that in real time, but I hadn't noticed a detail. The post was signed DJT, the president's initials, of course. But also, it's now been pointed out, it is the ticker symbol for Trump Media stock. A White House spokesperson said, quote, it is the responsibility of the President of the United States to reassure the markets and Americans about their economic security in the face of nonstop media fear-mongering, unquote. But is there an issue of cheerleading for the president's own company based on non-public information? And did others make trades who might have known the tariff turn was imminent? Senator Adam Schiff, a Democrat from California, is among those asking questions. I asked him if this is really all that strange.
Well, it would be strange for any other presidency. It's even a bit strange for this presidency. So there are both issues of potential market manipulation. Is he trying to push people to buy stock, including his own? But probably the more serious concern is this spike in call volume right before he made the announcement of this massive reversal in tariff policy. What accounts for that? It certainly appears on the surface that someone knew, maybe a lot of somebody's knew. And the question it begs is, were any of these people in the administration? Were they trading on insider information? This is a crowd that feels completely immune from accountability. There's really no oversight at the Justice Department. It's populated by Trump's criminal defense lawyers. So in that kind of a lawless environment, you have to be deeply concerned about this kind of corruption, and we're demanding answers.
Okay, but I mean, you're not going to bust any president for insider trading for making a public statement. It sounds like you're even more interested in how come some people were trading securities in advance of the announcement in a way that seemed to anticipate it.
Yes, but in a normal world, if you had a president that was trying to manipulate the market to benefit his own company, that is something that would be prosecuted. But of course, we're not in that world anymore, thanks to Chief Justice Roberts. We are now in a world where a president can engage in criminality as president and be immune from prosecution.
Senator Adam Schiff of California, if you look back at the DJT stock, it was up 6.7% in the hours after the president's "it's a great time to buy" message at a time that stock indexes were generally down hard. DJT stock would close up about 21% that day, but that jump was in the same direction as so many other stocks on the Wednesday of the tariff turnaround. In Los Angeles, I'm David Brancaccio. It's the Marketplace Morning Report. APM, American Public Media.